I do not believe we can keep doing the same thing for over 5 decades and expect a different result. Moreover, it does not serve America's interests or the Cuban people to try to push Cuba towards collapse. Even if that worked, and it hasn't for 50 years, we know from hard-earned experience that countries are more likely to enjoy lasting transformation if their people are not subjected to chaos.
5 years ago, President Obama did an about-face on a half-century-long Cold War-era diplomatic and economic standoff between the United States and Cuba. He eased restrictions on travel and trade with America's island neighbor. But, like so much of the 44th president's agenda and achievements, the 45th walked it back. President Trump put the so-called Cuban thaw back in the freezer. And now the White House is actively pushing out would-be Cuban immigrants, sending them back to either Mexico, where they tried to enter the United States, or deporting them to Cuba outright. Molly O'Toole has been following this closely. She is an immigration reporter for the LA Times based in Washington, D.C. Welcome back, Molly.
Thanks for having me.
So first, give me a little context here. Pre-Obama, what had U.S. policy been towards Cuban migrants and asylum seekers for pretty much 50 years?
Right. So it was actually mostly governed by the Cuban Adjustment Act, and that dates to 1966. And basically the idea is that if you encouraged Cubans to come to the United States and made it pretty easy for them to do that and then stay and give them a sort of permanent status and potentially a path to citizenship, you would undermine the Castro government and sort of hollow it out, and then potentially it would collapse. So this was the basic premise of the U.S. approach, its foreign policy and its immigration policy since the 60s. And that sort of gave rise to the policy known as wet foot, dry foot, yes, which meant that if a Cuban stepped foot on U.S. soil, was able to get there, then basically they were able to stay. And if they were caught at sea in the process of attempting, then they would be turned back to Cuba. And as you pointed out, Obama is one of his last moves, actually all the way into January 2017, so just a few days before Donald Trump took the oath of office, he ended that wet foot, dry foot policy. He didn't rescind the Cuban Adjustment Act, but basically he said that Cubans arriving at the southern border, at the land border, would more or less be treated like other migrants. And that's the basic premise of the U.S. approach. The Cuban Adjustment Act still exists, but by ending wet foot, dry foot, Obama was essentially denying the benefits of that to future Cubans.
But the overall immigration policy had been liberalized, correct? So the idea was perhaps wet foot, dry foot wasn't necessary anymore, is my understanding?
It did go hand in hand with some of the moves that the Obama administration had been making to sort of end the Cold War approach to Cuba. And actually, the Cuban government had been calling for a long time for wet foot, dry foot to end because it argued that this was an incentive for Cubans to leave for the United States. So as part of that normalization, the thinking was, well, you didn't really need this policy anymore. And actually, it was something that the Cuban government had asked for. And interestingly enough, the Trump administration supported this move very quietly, but they were essentially glad that Obama did it so they didn't have to, because it was sort of putting their approach to Cuba from a foreign policy standpoint, in which obviously the Trump administration has taken a very hard line against the Cuban government, reinstated a lot of those sanctions that the Obama administration had rolled back, at the same time as it can be a contradiction with their sort of restrictionist immigration policies, which would seek to keep Cubans and everyone else out.
Yeah. What do you think the broader policy is hoping to achieve? Are we going back to what we heard earlier, President Obama saying he wanted to end, trying to kind of make Cuba implode, basically?
Well, I think that's the explicit goal of the Trump administration. The thinking is that if you are hard enough on the Cuban government and make the economy bad enough, that the Cuban government will be overthrown by the Cuban people who have been made miserable by these economic policies. Now, that sort of approach to sanctions we've seen in Iran, we've seen in Venezuela. There aren't a lot of examples of that actually working, and clearly there's a very high human cost. It's also at odds with an immigration policy that tries to keep pretty much all migrants from reaching the United States, particularly by crossing over the U.S.-Mexico border, because it fuels migration.
Now, at first blush, I have to say, you know, deporting Cubans, not allowing more Cubans to immigrate doesn't seem like a wise political play. In Florida, you've got a large Cuban immigrant population. It has a lot of political power. They're often characterized as relatively conservative. Doesn't this crackdown potentially lose Trump some critical support in a swing state?
I think it potentially could because of that contradiction that I think is pretty obvious to see, with on the one hand saying that you stand with the Cuban people in their fight for freedom against the Cuban government at the same time as you're forcing them back to Mexico to these very dangerous border cities when they're seeking asylum in the United States, or removing them to that very government that you're railing against. I think that does open him up certainly for some critique, especially from the long-time Cuban population in the United States, you know, that fled different circumstances, a different context, you know, 50 years ago, but fled for similar reasons that these Cuban asylum seekers say they're fleeing, you know, oppression, a sort of autocratic government. But there are nuances in the Cuban population in the United States, which is important to note. It's not this monolith. Longtime Cuban residents tend to like the Trump administration's policies and its approach toward the Cuban government. They're a little less concerned about more recent Cuban migrants, which may mean that this doesn't rise to the level that it really punishes the Trump administration in Florida. But it's a little too soon to tell. They have been doing it quietly, though.
With that in mind, how has Congress reacted? And I'm thinking specifically about Florida Republican Marco Rubio, the son himself of Cuban exiles from Miami. What is he saying about this?
It's very interesting to talk to the members of Congress who are sort of Cuba hawks, you know, that they've continued to be very hard on Cuba. You know, many of them are Cuban Americans. We have Senator Menendez in New Jersey as well. And then, of course, Senator Rubio, who's perhaps the best known, but also Senator Ted Cruz. So Rubio had a very interesting position on it. He seemed to suggest it was sort of a rock in a hard place. He said, the deportations are terrible because they are being sent back to a place where there is a lot of political repression. But he also said, on the other hand, with the surge in migration at the border, it's very difficult to continue giving Cubans a sort of specialized status. And he said by pure resources alone. But the Cubans are in a very difficult position in that many of them, A, are trying to come the quote-unquote right way. The dramatic increase that we've seen, again, it was about 7,000 Cubans last year, and it's on pace to be about 20,000 Cubans. They're coming to ports of entry. So they're trying to cross the quote-unquote right way, to cross legally by registering asylum claims at ports of entry. It's also virtually impossible for them to get a visa to the United States because the U.S. has effectively pulled back all personnel from Cuba because of these sort of mysterious sonic attacks. So he seemed to recognize the difficult position that the Cubans are in, while also suggesting from a resource standpoint that, you know, the Cuban Adjustment Act and a policy that the United States has had from an immigration standpoint toward Cubans might be a little outdated. It might not fit the situation anymore.
While we're on the subject of border politics, yesterday, the American Civil Liberties Union reported the Trump administration had separated more than 900 children from their parents at the U.S. southern border. This after a federal judge, of course, ordered the practice to end last year. What do we know about this?
Well, we and others have been reporting on this, that family separation never stopped. It never stopped in a number of ways. The acting Homeland Security Secretary, Kevin MacLean, he said that family separations remain extraordinarily rare. And it's been difficult to sort of pin down the numbers on this. But we know that there are a number of circumstances in which Customs and Border Protection in particular, these agents are making these calls with very little oversight or potentially training and separating families. And they say it's for only under exceedingly rare circumstances where the child is potentially being endangered. But what the ACLU's filings showed us, and sort of the reporting has supported this, it seems as if they're sort of using what's supposed to be an extraordinarily rare situation in a pretty common way. You know, minor alleged offenses from traffic violations to property damage that was estimated to be $5. Sometimes there isn't even any alleged offense at all. There's the suspicion of some kind of gang tie, and there's been a lot of reporting that, you know, many of that ultimately didn't hold up, but the families are being separated. Another thing that we had reported on that's occurring is they're separating families where it's not apparent. And this is really common in Central America. A lot of these family units are headed by grandparents, uncles, aunts. And if you're traveling to the border with a grandparent or an uncle or an aunt or even older siblings where one is a minor and one isn't, they will be separated. And the DHS is not actually tracking those cases and is putting them in the same category as potentially questionable family ties, essentially putting them in the same category as fraud. So we hear a lot from the administration about how common family fraud is. But then on the other hand, there's also a lot of evidence that they're continuing to separate families in under sort of dubious allegations. So it's a number of things here going on in which what's supposed to be exceedingly rare appears to be increasingly common, and for very young children. Approximately 20% of those 911 new separations since the court ruling in June of 2018 affected children under 5 years old.
This story obviously keeps rolling on. Molly O'Toole covers immigration for the LA Times. Thank you so much.
Thanks for having me.
Coming up, 100 years of history, the patronage of the late Charlie Chaplin, and possibly the best martini in these United States. We talk to the CFO and proprietor of Hollywood's Musso & Frank Grill, next on Press Play.
Introducing the KCRW donation car, designed to be recycled. This first-of-its-kind vehicle will save you time, space, and hassle by disappearing. Enjoy the luxury and comfort of turning your underused car into a donation worth hundreds, even thousands of dollars. The KCRW donation car, already in your garage, driveway, or on cinder blocks outside your house. Act now at kcrw.com/cars.
This is Press Play. I'm Rico Galliano, in for Madeline Brand. There is an often quoted statistic that the majority of restaurants fail within the first 3 years of business. So Musso & Frank Grill has officially beaten the odds many, many times over. It'll celebrate 100 years in business this September. The restaurant first opened its doors on Hollywood Boulevard before Hollywood had a Walk of Fame, before there was a Hollywood sign, for that matter. And its mid-century opulence, as anyone who's been there knows, has been preserved as if in amber. When Quentin Tarantino shot a scene there for his new film Once Upon a Time in Hollywood, which is set in 1969, he pretty much didn't have to change one thing. Mark Echeverria is the restaurant's CFO and proprietor. He is also a descendant of one of this landmark's very early co-owners, and he joins us now. Hello, Mark.
Hello.
So give us your bona fides. This place has been in your family for how many generations now?
The restaurant's been in our family since 1927.
Yes.
My great-grandfather bought it back then with his business partner. And they ran it 50-50 together until about 2009 when our family bought out the other family. And so now it's all in one family.
And his name, I should note?
John Musso, M-O-S-S-O.
Yes, not Musso, Musso.
Correct.
What is your earliest memory of the place? I'm imagining you as a kid being given like Sprite in a martini glass or something.
Very close. It was a Shirley Temple in a martini glass.
Really?
Yeah, I was probably 4 years old. With my mom, my aunts, my cousins, and my grandmother, who was running the restaurant at the time. And we were all in a booth 238, or 237, sorry.
You remember the number of the booth?
Absolutely, absolutely.
How is that possible?
Well, I probably wouldn't have known the number when I was 4 years old, but now after managing the restaurant for about 10 years, I know the number quite well.
Tell me about that experience. What did it feel like?
The level of sophistication that I felt as a 4 year old was just unreal. I mean, you're getting, you know, a Shirley Temple in a martini glass, and you're watching all these adults next to you drinking martinis. Although I didn't know what they were back then,
yeah.
I thought they were drinking the same thing I was.
Mm-hmm.
And you know, that level of sophistication was certainly felt even at that young age, and that's certainly something that we want the next generation of Musso customer to feel too when they start out at 4 years old.
Were you dressed up at that time? Were people like dressing up still to go to that place?
Yeah, in fact, I think there's a photo of me, not necessarily on this particular night, but I think there's a photo of me and my cousins in like little sport coats and stuff running around the kitchen. You know, it's kind of cute.
There are so many stories told about the various celebrities that haunted Musso's back in the day. What's your favorite?
Probably, and it's a story that we're going to put in the book, which...
there's a book, isn't there?
There's a book coming out, and...
we'll let you hype that at the end.
Sure. but it's a story that we haven't really told until this book, and it's called Ruben's Magnificent Moment, where he actually had to get in between...
Ruben was a bartender.
Ruben Rueda, yes. He was a bartender who, unfortunately, just recently passed away.
He'd been working there 60-some years, I think?
52. Close.
You know?
But it was a story that he had to actually break up a fight between Steve McQueen and Charles Bukowski.
Oh, my God.
So, I mean.
Who do you think would have won that fight had Ruben not stepped in?
I don't know, but I'm going to say Ruben won it.
Well, there you go. How did he do it? Those are two bruisers, I
feel like. He was great friends with both of them. So he just got in between the middle of them, said, you go out the front, you go out the back, and I'll drive each of you home at the end of the night.
Really?
And he did.
Oh, man, those guys, that's like an honor, I would think, to be driven home by Ruben.
Right? I would say so.
One of the top honors. To be clear, the Musso we dine in today is not exactly the Musso that opened back in 1919, correct?
That is correct.
It started where?
It actually started right next door at 6669 Hollywood Boulevard.
Yes.
And we moved to the current location in 1934. And when we moved over there, they opened up at 6667, and everything in that room, we call it the old room, it's the room with the grill and the dining room.
Yep.
Everything in that room is original to 1934, minus the leather in the banquettes. Those had to be changed throughout the decades.
Really?
But the wallpaper's the same, the wood's the same, the grill is the same, everything is the same. So you really can come in there and get, you know, that true antiquity feeling from 1934.
And then you opened up the other room, the room that has the bar, shortly thereafter, maybe a couple of decades thereafter?
Yeah, we opened up what we call the new room in 1955, which is new to Musso's, right? 1955 is new to Musso's.
It's a different language when you're talking about Musso's.
And when they opened up that new room, they made it a direct replica from this old back room that we used to have when we were just operating in that old room that was built in 34. Mm. And it was that old back room was towards the back of the Vogue Theater. And that's where all the literary giants, mm-hmm. Leviathans, would come and hang out, the F. Scott Fitzgeralds, the William Saroyans, and that's where they would all hang out. And when they had to expand the restaurant in 1955, they made that new room a direct replica. And they moved everything they could over from that old back room.
So it's the original bar.
It is the original bar from 1934, right after Prohibition. They built that bar and then moved it over. So you can still come into Musso's today and sit and get that energy from mm-hmm. those old writers. And we see that quite often.
Now explain, why did it become such a haunt for writers?
Well, the Screenwriters Guild used to be across the street from Musso's.
Yep.
And way back then, the studios were hiring novelists to come in and write their screenwrites. And what a novelist thought should be up on the screen was a little bit different than what a studio exec should be up there on the screen. And
nothing's certainly changed since then.
Right. And so the novelist would submit, and the studio execs would redline a whole bunch of stuff. And of course, that would hit the ego of the novelist. They'd go to the Screenwriters Guild to complain, and then go across the street and drown their miseries. We'll put it that way.
And it's never changed.
No,
ever since. I have one question, actually. Given all of this history, though. So there's a seat in the main dining room at Musso's that is typically said to have been Charlie Chaplin's seat.
Yes.
It's the only seat that has a window. And I guess the lore is that he would sit at that window so that he could keep an eye on his horse, which would be tied up outside, correct?
That is correct.
But we've just said that that room didn't open until the 1930s, right?
Correct.
Were there still horses like wandering up and down Hollywood Boulevard in the 30s?
Not wandering, but certainly over at his studio in La Brea, they were still shooting with horses for certain movies, and him and Rudolph would race their horses.
Rudolph Valentino?
Valentino, yeah.
Oh, my God.
But I think he was usually the unlucky participant, but I don't think Charlie would be discriminatory on anybody. He would race anybody to the restaurant. Loser would have to buy.
Yeah, right. The idea is that he would race from what studio to?
From his studio down on La Brea.
Oh, right, Charlie's studio.
Mm-hmm.
My God. In any case, but Musso's basically unchanged since the 50s.
Yep.
Right down to the menu. I got to imagine at some point in those intervening 60-some years, the place must have seemed just hopelessly out of fashion. There must have been pressure to modernize. There's pressure for restaurants that opened 3 years ago in Hollywood to modernize. How did your family resist that?
You know, our family, going back to my great-grandfather, has always had a very rich respect for history. So it's not inherent in us to change anything. And yeah, we have been asked and gotten some pressure to maybe change or modernize anything, but the restaurant's always been on a good road. And why make a left turn for no reason?
But is that 100% true? I mean, I can't imagine that at some point in, say, the 70s or something, when that the type of food that you serve there, the atmosphere is just completely not in keeping. Now I think there's a respect for that era, but at the time it must have just seemed like old hat.
You know, certainly in 100 years you're going to see peaks and valleys of interest and sure. sales and whatever, just given economics. But I think when you start to evaluate what your customers are truly looking for, you have to listen to them. And we've never had a vast majority of our customers say change. And in fact, it's been very, very much the opposite. Don't change, don't change, don't change. And I think throughout the existence of the restaurant, we've always listened to that. And it seems to match up with what our philosophy is, which is don't change.
I would be remiss if I didn't ask you about really the only essential item on the menu, which is, of course, the martini. Still the best in the country, if you ask me.
Thank you.
I will be damned if I could tell you, though, why gin and vermouth in a glass at Musa's tastes better than gin and vermouth in a glass anywhere else. What is the secret?
Well, I love to say it, and I kind of hate to say it, but James Bond was actually wrong.
No.
You have to stir the martini.
Oh,
don't shake it.
And
there's a specific kind of a recipe on how many times you stir the martini and then ultimately how we serve the martini. We serve them in relatively small martini glasses
yep.
with a little sidecar that has the rest of the martini chilled on ice. So every single sip that you're getting in that martini through the drink is crisp and cold. And I think that's really marks the difference.
But I will say, you know, that you're not the only place in town that does that. The Smokehouse in Burbank also does that. And yet I think it's generally assumed that yours is the king of the martinis. Why is your little carafe on ice better than the Smokehouse?
Well, I think it comes down to who makes it and where it's made and the stories that you can tell while making it.
Mike Echeverria is CFO and proprietor of Musso and Frank Grill. Thank you so much, sir.
My pleasure. Thank you, Rico.
And we have Warren Olney here with us. And we're going to talk about what's on your podcast, To the Point, the podcast, aptly titled. What's going on in the show?
All right. Well, thank you. First of all, thank you very much for being here. We're going to be talking about the Democratic debates. And I think it's important to point out we recorded it before the debates actually occurred, hoping that, and I think trusting, and I believe succeeding, in presenting something that will be useful even after the debates. And the big question is, are there enough bold ideas being presented by the Democratic candidates or too many bold ideas being presented by the Democratic candidates? And what about the moderators? And are they really doing their jobs? Are they asking the kinds of questions that need to be asked, especially about foreign policy?
All right. That's on To the Point, the podcast. You can download that on Apple Podcasts or wherever podcasts are podcasted. Thanks, Warren.
Thank you.
Coming up, comedian Eliza Schlesinger is known for her satirical bits about what it means to be a woman.
Speak your mind, be brave, be bold. But when you are, it's like, sit down. You're too bold. You're making me insecure.
She'll tell us what it takes to make a Netflix special. That is next on Press Play. This is Press Play. I'm Rico Galliano, in for Madeline Brand. Comedian Eliza Schlesinger knows a thing or two about the dating scene.
You ask a girl, how did you guys meet? We want to tell you. We want to tell you everything. We want to give you personal information, background story, ancillary information, anything. Information you don't need. Just like, how do we meet? Okay, are you sitting down? So, chapter one, in the seventh grade, I showed an aptitude for the clarinet. Like, we take it back. You ask a guy, how did you guys meet? Men aren't, they don't volunteer personal information as readily. Seldom will you meet a guy where you're like, how did you guys meet? And he's like, all right, so I'm a Pisces, so I love faces. Like,
Between her satirical bits about the difference between men and women, she weaves in some very serious social commentary.
Men are better at dealing with rejection sexually. Women are not used to dealing with rejection when it comes to sex. We're used to dealing with rejection when it comes to the idea of, I don't know, governing our own bodies, having our own thoughts, getting paid the same for the same job a man does. But when it comes...
That is from her latest Netflix special, her fourth. It's called Elder Millennial. And now she's put out a behind-the-scenes documentary about how she does that, prepares for a Netflix special. And Madeline sat down with Eliza earlier.
All right. How many Netflix specials? Five?
I have four, and we just shot the fifth one, so that will be out momentarily.
Okay, so you have this new documentary out, too, which shows how all of that happens, the behind the scenes of creating a Netflix special. Mm-hmm. And it seems to me a lot of grind.
It's a hustle. It's a hustle.
So how many shows a week do you do to prepare?
For my process, you know, we pick a date and you're kind of gearing up to it. You're touring all year, you know, to make your living and do your job. And then you pick that date and you kind of back into it with like several months. If you can't get a theater date, then you'll pick a club and you'll just run it, you know, 5, 6, 7, 8 hours, you know, that weekend, 8 shows, 5 shows, 7 shows, whatever. I say 8 shows, that's a little ambitious, but you just, and so every weekend, Thursday through Saturday or Sunday, if you had a show, you're out running it once or twice a night.
Do you work it out on stage?
Yes.
You don't write it beforehand?
Right. Correct.
Are you doing it ad lib? You're just kind of coming up with stuff in your head in the moment?
Yes, I write on stage. So, you know, you have a premise or you have a joke that I've been doing and I do it and then a tag pops into your head. Or
just right then and there.
Right then and there. And that really is part of the talent, and then everything else is part of the craft. The raw talent is coming up with those on-the-spot funny ad-libs or conclusions or tags or punchlines. And then the art of it and the craft of it is doing that again. Why didn't that get a laugh? Should I do it slower? Should I do it here? Should I abandon it all together? And actually putting these components together. Because anyone can get a laugh. The trick is, can you get that laugh every time? Can you keep doing it?
This sounds very precise and calculated. That seems...
Because it sounds so evil.
It sounds evil.
Right.
But I don't mean it calculated that way, but just really thought out, organized plan. Sounds like almost like you have a PowerPoint. Like this is how you do it.
You know, the precision, I think that's what separates the amateur from the professional, is that precision and how polished it is versus I'm just up there like, what do you guys want to talk about? I don't know. These people are trusting you to guide them on a journey of your thoughts. And so you can't be lost, and you need to speak specifically and know that you have a plan and where you're going to take them. And you can't give them a reason to doubt you, because then you'll lose them.
It's hard, right?
Sometimes it's really hard.
Sometimes it's very hard.
Sometimes it's easy, but when it's easy, you don't notice it.
Well, I mean, it's not hard to. I mean, it seems fun to be in show business. Let's put it that way.
It seems the operative word.
Yeah.
Yeah, it seems
but then
real fun.
Watching your special, it did not seem fun at all. I don't mean your special, your documentary.
Yeah, the documentary for sure. I do enjoy what I do. Like, it's not fun to be sick on the road, but at the end of the day, I love traveling. And the schlep of it is so a part of who I am. And so the difficulty's been built in. You know, now I have a tour manager and a merch person and a feature act and somebody that helps me and receives me, and they do everything. And when I started, it was just me by myself, flying coach with a duffel bag of my own merch. And I'd do my show and then I'd run off and I'd go outside and I'd hold up my T-shirts and people would take pictures and they'd say things like, we got these tickets for free on the radio. You're pretty funny for a girl. Like, meaning the best. But I was literally like, grabbing each fan one at a time and plucking them out and ingratiating myself. So even in that documentary, like, my assistant drove me to the airport. That was not always the case. It was definitely me staying up till 4 a.m, calling a cab, getting myself there or leaving my car at the airport, you know?
Yeah.
So as difficult as that looked for you, it was much difficult before that.
But yet worth it for you, obviously.
Worth it because I love it. Yeah. And also when you're young and like when you're in your 20s, you don't realize how crappy things are. You don't realize that, like, this junior suite twin bed at the Holiday Inn, like, next to an auto parts store, like, is not as great as things could be. You have the energy and the stamina, you're just doing it. And I wasn't even going in a direction. I was just doing my job.
It's a solo gig, pretty much.
Yes.
This job. And it's less so now, as you say, when you've got assistants right. and managers and all that stuff. But it's just you on stage. That's it. You have only yourself to blame if things go badly, mm-hmm. and you get all the glory if they go well.
Yeah, it's like high risk stocks and bonds. You know, like there's the risk in doing that. High risk, high yield.
Yeah.
And the risk being your emotional state and being alone on a stage when no one laughs, which hurts less the older you get, the more you do it. There's less of a fear there. But you are responsible for your material. I write my own jokes. I'm responsible for my persona, what I say, the moments on stage. If I bring up a topic people didn't like, I said something, it came off the wrong way. Like, I own that. And you deal with it. And people are going to love you. And then some people are always going to be a little pissed. But that's just the nature of humans.
Yeah, of course. Yeah. And so, but it seems like you don't really care about their reactions too much. Like, you're going to say what you want to say. You want them to laugh.
Yes.
But you have a point of view that you want to get across.
Point of view and this inherent notion that like what I have to say is very important. I think that's at the core of a lot of comedians. And there are times I was doing a show recently, a local show, and the crowd wasn't bad. They just kind of weren't there yet. You know, they weren't reeling from the last comic. And I stopped. I go, I am here making $15. It's a Wednesday. I don't need your validation. And they laughed. I was like, this does not make her. These jokes are already on the Netflix special. It's already been validated. Your opinion is irrelevant. So drink the drinks and get on board. But this doesn't mean anything to me. And I didn't even wear deodorant here because I don't sweat you. You mean nothing. And they ate it up.
Really?
Yeah, because if you let them know that their passive dismissal of you meant something to you, then they get like power hungry. And sometimes they don't realize that they're a bad crowd. And when you tell them, then they kind of shakes them out of it.
It's kind of like dealing with teenagers.
I would imagine. Just thinking how my mother dealt with me like last year. You can't let them know you're afraid of them. And you can't let them know they're bothering you.
Exactly.
Yeah, so there you go.
There you go. But the point that you want to get across or what you want to say, you said you have things to say that are important that you want people to hear.
I got things.
You got things. A lot of it obviously has to do with being a woman and being... Mm-hmm. Or being a girl, as you say. Whatever.
Interchangeable terms.
Does that matter to you, the distinction?
No. Some people get really uppity about it.
Yeah, they do.
Girl's like a fun term, and woman, mm-hmm. when I want you to listen to me. Now I'm a woman. But when I'm having fun, I'm a girl.
Well, that's another bit that you do about all the contradictions that women, girls have sure. to embody, mm-hmm. which is wearing. But it seems like there are a lot of hats that we have to wear now.
There's a lot of hats, and in this new special, which is not out yet, I really kind of go in on this idea that we now as women are obsessed with policing other women,
mm-hmm.
And just how exhausting that is and how contradictory in nature that is to, you know, tell, you know, speak your mind, be brave, be bold. But when you are, it's like, sit down. You're too bold. You're making me insecure.
Yeah.
And just like, it's still just so paralyzing because you're offending everyone by existing.
I want to play another clip from your special, your last special. You're engaged in this one. Now
in that
married.
One. No, I'm married.
No, you're married. But here you are as an engaged person.
Okay.
You walk into a Trader Joe's with a ring on your left hand. Single women can feel the vibrations of the ring. They're like, the ring, it mocks us. And they come out of the frozen yogurt aisle. Lululemon, highlighted hair, like, tell us your ways. We wish to be betrothed as well.
I was like, please let that be it. So hard to listen to.
Is it? Why?
Just myself. I don't know.
I love what you're doing there because it's like you're doing two or three things there, right? You're criticizing the fact that women are looking at your ring and just, mm-hmm. you know, they want to get married and then sure. the bling and the thing on the finger and blah, 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 and the whole... And just all of the trappings of that particular woman that you just mm-hmm. see that woman with the Lululemon.
Mm-hmm.
But also, I think it's also, you know, as you say, women like to criticize each other, that mm-hmm. you're also criticizing yourself in that.
1,000%. I wouldn't have the license to do it had I not been that girl. And so if women ever get offended, I'm like, what else is, if you can't make fun of your own experience, then what can I talk about? Because I can't talk about being any other type of woman other than the woman I've been.
Mm-hmm.
And that's, I think, one of the few rewards of getting older is having the perspective and being able to make fun of it with such a full heart because I am that girl. I will be that girl that, you know, wears workout clothes to Trader Joe's. And so it's said with love.
Right. And so now that you're married.
Yeah. We're divorced now.
You are?
No.
Oh, okay. That was fast. Back to Trader Joe's for you.
Back to the frozen yogurt aisle.
Yeah. So married jokes in the next special?
The ones coming out is about, it's a heavy commentary on the act of marriage and all the BS that goes into it. And I'm just sort of unearthing some of that. I think as women, sometimes we're not allowed to complain because it's like, well, at least the Lord sent you someone to put up with you taking pictures of your dog's mouth. And you're not supposed, you're supposed to be preparing for this day your whole life. And I'm, a lot of the commentary in this, I'm like, I can love the person I've married. I can love the product of the marriage. But I got to tell you, the day of was a little stressful. It wasn't that graceful. You know, and the party was great and the pictures are great. But just kind of unearthing some of the madness, I think, as women, we're so programmed to do the smile and, you know, hashtag perfect day.
Yeah.
Look at this. And it's like, yeah, you can. But also, let's be real about my experience.
Well, I think everyone has that to a certain degree, mm-hmm. right? I mean, it was a stressful event.
And I was one of those women that didn't engage in the wedding planning process. I was on tour. I was just like, whatever. My mom helped me with a lot of it. And I should have been more mentally present because I was not prepared for the emotions that hit me that day.
Hmm.
That's on me.
The emotions of?
Everything. Just of the, how profound it all is, how big it is. And then as a comic, we're very dark. So when they opened the doors for me to walk down the aisle, you could hear me go, this is so weird. Because everyone you care about is there. And then my next thought was, this is the last time all of these people will be together before someone dies. That was going through my head.
Wow. Okay.
Oh. So just those thoughts and just like, oh my God, like this is it. It's like, it's just, it was big. It was a lot to mentally process.
Like this is it. This is the end of one part of my life and the beginning of another.
Very much that. That's a big part of it.
And like there's like a mourning for that old life.
I'm so glad you said that because I was like, am I just a lunatic? You know, you spend your whole life as a woman trying to, you know, dating, find Mr. Right. I'm independent. I don't need it. Like going back and forth. And then you meet and then you get married and that all comes to a screeching halt. Like, yes, you've been with this person, but all those senses and all those things and all those nights out, you know, it's different. Your Saturday night out now is different. The way that you feel about your body, even sexually, is different. It's not like I'm in like a conservative marriage, but like, I don't remember the last time I wore a low cut shirt because that part of me kind of dies away. Like you just care a little bit less.
Yeah.
Not in a let yourself go away, but in a, that's the cow sold. And just all these energies that you've put toward finding that person and being okay without a person, all that stuff, that is done and you've got a different chapter. And so there's just a lot to process, yeah. Unpack. None of it's bad or good. It's just different.
And now you're a wife.
And now I'm a wife. And this is.
Sort of.
Yeah.
So in your career, you've attained a certain level of success, celebrity. You've made it.
Mm-mm.
What?
I made it here today. This is the biggest thing in my week.
I'm sorry. I'm very sorry for you. Well, I guess I'm wondering what is making it then for you?
I think that's a shifting goalpost. And every time I talk to someone, and this is a frustration of mine. People are always like, well, you'll never be happy. And I'm like, at least let me get to happiness before I tell you if I don't like it. I guess at the end of the day, the goal can't be to be the most famous comic ever because that's subjective. Even being funny is subjective. So right now I'm really just enjoying the touring and the other creative stuff and the fans and how great they are.
Are the fans mainly women?
No, it's 50-50.
Is it?
Yeah. If you troll my Instagram, you'll see all different kinds, but they are very special. They make gifts. When my dog passed away, which was recently, they brought gifts for her in memory of her, the letters they write. There's a real connection I have with them that I don't know. I think I'm kind of known for that. And there's an honesty that we have. It's kind of this agreement. I'm like, I'll let you in and be vulnerable and you buy my tickets.
And right. Maybe make me a little thing.
Make me a little thing. Bring me a thing.
Buy a ticket.
Buy my ticket.
And laugh.
Yeah.
Hopefully.
Yeah, hopefully. But if you don't, that's your fault, not mine.
Comedian Eliza Schlesinger. You can see her new documentary Over and Over on Amazon Prime, iTunes, Google Play. She's performing at the Irvine Improv August 1st, 2nd, and 3rd. Thank you.
Thank you so much.
Steve Chiotakis is here now to tell us what's coming up on his show, Greater LA. Steve, what you got for us?
Just a few minutes. By the way, welcome to the fold, Rico.
Thank you. Oh, my
nice
gosh.
Nice to have you
Do
on our
hazed?
Air. Rico and I have worked together for many years, and we did so at Marketplace.
Oh, my
like,
gosh.
In a past life.
I barely remember it. But
yeah,
what's happening coming up? Let's talk about the future.
We're going to talk about the chaos at the LA City Council chambers yesterday, where, in fact, they passed a city ordinance that would make it harder for you to sleep in your car if have nowhere else to go.
All right.
So the homeless issue, of course, keeps giving. As we say, and we'll talk about it coming up at 1 o'clock.
That's on Greater LA. Coming up on this show, real Hollywood history obviously lives at Musso and Frank, but on those ubiquitous Hollywood bus tours, not so much. We'll give you the dirt on them in the latest edition of our series, hashtag Stay Home, next on Press Play. This is Press Play. I'm Rico Galliano, filling in for Madeline Brand. For this week's edition of our summer series, hashtag Stay Home, we're looking at our own backyard, Hollywood.
This is no longer a vacation. It's a quest. It's a quest for fun.
If you want fun, then listen to this. New York's hottest club is Slice.
I want to go someplace where I can marvel at something.
Are we there yet?
Hollywood has lured tourists from around the world, all hoping to steal a little sparkle from Tinseltown. One way tourists can get a taste of all that glamour is, of course, with a bus tour. If you've been to Hollywood Boulevard or the Sunset Strip, you've certainly seen them. There's open-air vans with a bunch of people sitting on the roof. There's a driver yelling into a headset, pointing out historic buildings and celebrities' houses. But these buses frequently give out misleading or just wrong information about who lives in those mansions and which celebrity died where. Meanwhile, if you ask an Angelino, they'll pretty much tell you this isn't the best way to get a taste of the Hollywood experience and that adding a bunch of big, slow vehicles to Hollywood streets isn't exactly making the place more livable. Here to talk about the bus blitzkrieg and also perhaps some alternatives to which you can helpfully guide your out-of-town guests is Zoe Matthew. Her article about these tours can be found in the current issue of Los Angeles Magazine. Hi, Zoe.
Hi, how's it going?
Very good. And we also have Chris Nichols, who is author of Los Angeles Magazine's Ask Chris column. Hello to you. Welcome back.
Hello. Good to be here.
I have lived here now for 25 years, people, and I've honestly never been on one of these bus tours. I don't see the allure that makes me spend more time in traffic. So, Zoe, please just describe the experience for me. What is this like?
Well, you know, it kind of depends on which of the tours you're taking. Obviously, there are the kind of more commercial ones like Starline, which are more fact-checked and they're kind of like bigger operations. But in recent years, since the explosion of the tourism industry, there have been a growing number of these kind of smaller, more ragtag tour bus companies where they would just ask the people kind of what stars' houses they wanted to see, and then they would just drive to really nice houses in the hills.
Because that
kind
of...
like, oh yeah, that's, you know, Julia Roberts' house or whatever.
Okay, that answers my next question, because I was going to say, like, why do you have to make up stuff? I mean, Hollywood is full of actual historic buildings and there are stars' houses there, but they just cater this fantasy tour for whoever happens to be on the bus, is what you're saying.
Basically, yeah. And, you know, people aren't going to know any different. They came to see these houses and the tour guides get tips. They want to please their audience, so they're just telling them what they want to hear, essentially.
How do local residents take this? Like, what are they saying to the bus drivers? What's their reaction?
The local residents I spoke to were not stoked about these tours coming through their neighborhoods all the time. They basically complain not only about like the noise issues that it causes. One of them described the sound of it. He said, it's like listening to a drunk carnival barker screaming through a PA system outside my window.
What's wrong with that?
He said he'll just be like sitting in his bedroom on a Sunday and like 20 times a day, you know, these tours will stop by his house. And,
oh my gosh.
You know, apparently his neighbor across the street is not famous and they'll say like, oh, that's Quentin Tarantino's house. And, you know, so there's the noise complaints, but then there's also complaints of like people coming back and, you know, doing like vandalism or kind of going through people's trash to find souvenirs of celebrities that they think think live there and stuff like that. So.
I had not even thought of that. You got like stalkers outside your house.
Yeah.
Chris, I have to ask, what do you think people really want out of this experience? To me, regardless of who's behind the door, why do I care really?
I mean, those celebrity home tours, I think that you want, if you're running one, you probably would love to be able to cast it. Like, you know, here's an easy street. It's got parking. It's got access. And X, Y, and Z, who everybody wants to see, live all next door to each other in this, you know, bucolic little neighborhood that's a block off Hollywood Boulevard. But, you know, the reality is that the celebrity homes are as far flung as Los Angeles itself. And so, you know, you're not going to be able to put together that kind of a tour. I think that the celebrity home tour started out, you know, I guess probably in the 30s, maybe as like a map. You know, you'd buy a map and just go on your own.
Star maps.
And so, I suppose it's, and they still do that, but I think that it's probably, you know, you come here and you want to do that, and you can hop on one of these buses right on the boulevard. It's easy to get on. They've got these, you know, guys hawking it right on the street. You know, I don't know. I mean, I love giving tours to tourists, to people from out of town, to friends and family. It's one of my favorite things is to get in the car and take people around and explain what's happening here because it's not obvious to the naked eye.
Yeah. So let's get into it. I mean, I think we can agree you're not going to get like the kind of spiritual Hollywood Boulevard experience on Hollywood Boulevard anymore. That's a great place to see a movie or get harassed by a guy in a Spider-Man suit. Where do you take them when you take people around town?
Well, first of all, I love Hollywood Boulevard. I love that it literally sparkles. You know, that the pavement is glittery.
That's true.
I love the Chinese Theater. I know we overlook it. We take it for granted. It's awesome. I love the Pantages, and I love the Broadway shows there. I love the Magic Castle. I love Yamashiro. I love the pool at the Roosevelt. I love Michelli's. I was there last night, and there was like an hour-long concert of Disney songs.
The Italian restaurant, yeah.
Like that's neat, you know? Like, where are you going to get live piano doing, you know, piano gags for an hour? It was very funny and heartfelt.
But maybe let's get off the boulevard. Where would you take it? But let's start with some place nearby for maybe those tourists unwise enough to try to do this town without a car. What's near the boulevard, but perhaps still a deep cut for them?
Well, I mean, you know, my deep cuts start far away. I mean, if I have the time, I take people out to the Mission. You know, I try to start in the 18th century and explain how the people that sort of built the first buildings here and sort of go from there. I go around downtown and go through the different, you know, the different districts, the old Italian district, the old French district, through Chinatown and Little Tokyo. I take people to the San Gabriel Valley where I'm from and sort of try to show a different sort of speed, you know, showing LA at its sort of mid-century era speed where things are slower and farther apart and there's a more languid sort of rhythm to the streets and the restaurants and the sort of architecture out there.
I open this up to the both of you. How about the valley, the oft-maligned valley? A lot of movies are made there. There's a lot of history there. I know the Brady Bunch, the original Brady Bunch house is out there in the valley. Any place, points of interest you'd direct people to?
Probably the Valley History Museum is supposed to be really great, right, Chris?
Well, the Valley Relics Museum is pretty fantastic. It's in a warehouse at the Van Nuys Airport, and it is filled with neon signs and pinball machines and nudie rodeo tailor suits and his crazy Cadillac with the longhorns on it.
Yeah, nudie the tailor, who made kind of sort of Western outfits for the stars for a long time, correct?
Yeah, in North Hollywood. All that stuff came from North Hollywood. You know, and of course, my great interest in mid-century era, of course, I go to Bob's Big Boy in Toluca Lake.
Oh, yeah.
You know, which is also, you know, sometimes a star hangout, but, you know, of the sort of lower-level TV variety.
They also have a night where hot rodders show up and sort of show off their rides, correct?
Yeah, every Friday night. But, you know, like, I hear Jay Leno shows up at that once in a while.
All right.
And that's fun. That's a neat thing, and they do it every week. And it's open 24 hours a day.
And what about one far-flung recommendation? If you got a car and you really want to take a trip, where's the place that is going to blow everybody's mind?
Gosh, I don't know. I mean, I love lots of little secret places. I mean, I really love the old mill in Pasadena, San Marino area. It's this beautiful garden around this kind of adobe house that was the mill where they, you know, they ground wheat for the Mission. And it just feels so, like, kind of fundamental. It's a beautiful place to spend an afternoon. There's an art gallery and a garden and everything. But it also feels like the sort of base mineral from which LA was created. You know, I really dig it.
All right. So perhaps that instead of the Huntington Gallery up there. Yeah. Zoe Matthews and Chris Nichols, writers from LA Magazine, thank you so much for joining us.
Thank you.
And finally today, our own Michelle Aloy is here with feedback. She's been monitoring the social mediaverse to see what you, the people, are talking about. What is digitally percolating,
Michelle? The tweeter pipes. Pulse of the tweeter pipes. Mm. So we asked people where they take their friends and family when they come to visit in L.A. Just heard our...
And nobody had anything to say.
No, they had some great ideas. Cannon Tassi says she took her cousins from Germany to the movies at the Hollywood Forever Cemetery. I have done this. Good choice.
Good call.
Sarah says City Hall observation deck. A.S. Paul says the Getty.
The City Hall observation deck?
Yeah, that's a new one for me too.
Yeah.
I hadn't heard about that. Admittedly, I've only been here for a couple years though, so I'll have to check that out.
I didn't know that was even accessible.
Also good call, A.S. Paul.
Nice. What else?
Brooks McKinney says Point Vicente on the Palos Verdes Peninsula. Spectacular views of the ocean and coastline. Chelsea Pope says Groundlings and Griffith Observatory. Cantrip Candle says my hidden tourist spot is a quick trip to a wonderfully immersive plant store called Mickey Hargitay's.
An immersive plant store?
I have been there, actually. I have a number of plants from there.
Really?
Yeah.
What makes it immersive?
You kind of feel like you're just walking in the jungle. It's a really cool plant shop. I have to recommend it.
I love it. Everybody, that's it for Press Play today. Thank you, Michelle. And don't forget, folks, you can download or subscribe to the Press Play podcast and listen whenever you want on Apple Podcasts or at kcrw.com/pressplay. I'm Rico Galliano. We'll see you again tomorrow.